I want to ask you a question. You have a lot of respect, devotion, obeisance towards all that we do here, don't you? It's pretty obvious that you do. The way in which you respect the Mahasangha, the way in which you hold the monks, particularly the monks, in high regard, but of course that extends to the Anagarikas, the Anagarikas, Upasakas and Upasikas, which includes yourself. When you bring yourselves here, as you walk through those gates, we see that. The respect and regard that you have towards one another. What more should I say about the Mahasangha? Why is that? Think about this. Why do you have this respect? As Swami Nohase walked in through this door today, two gentlemen who had flown down from, I don't know where, but from somewhere, they were showing their utmost respect, down on their knees, showing respect to someone they may never have met before. But they'll understand that this is a monk. But why is that? Someone we've never met before. Yeah, I understand if you did that towards your mother, to your father, to the bank manager. Makes sense. I understand that. To your other half even. I've seen people on one knee. But why? Why do you do that in front of a monk who has nothing to offer you? Everyone in this room is richer than I am. Not you. Not you lot at the back either. But you. You have more to your name than I will ever throughout my life. At least the rest of my life. I will never have anything that comes even close to what you have today. But why do you show such respect? All I have is a robe and an alms bowl. Why such respect, I ask you? Wonderful. Because you understand that you have found the truth in associating the Mahasangha. This is what you hold in high regard. And that is what you respect. Isn't it? And that is what we respect. We respect the fact that you respect the truth. So much so that if from here on, what we begin to share with you is not the truth, and you still follow us blindly. And if I say, Baba, black sheep, and you say, have you any wool? And I say, yes, sir, yes, sir. And you say, three bags full. And we say, you know, that is the truth. Then I have to think that you have not understood any Dhamma at all. And you're just blind followers. I don't respect that. I don't think that deserves anyone's respect. Because, you know, a dog can follow a man blindly. A sheep can follow a shepherd blindly. But to get to Nibbana, you can't do it blindly. Yes, someone sees the light before we do, and then they show it to us, and then we follow in the direction of that light. We may follow in their footsteps, but because we are all looking at the same light. That's why. So this respect, this devotion, this obeisance, this obedience that you have is all towards that truth. That is why we get on our knees in front of the Lord Buddha. That is why we offer flowers at his feet. That is why we offer the oil lamps. That is why we make offerings to the Noble Triple Gem. Because we understand that in the Noble Triple Gem, we find the truth that sets us free. It is true, is it not, that throughout your lives, you've been looking for truth. You've been looking for the truth. The truth that would set you free. By free, I mean that you'd be happy. We've all been looking for that, but we could never find it in the ventures that we took until the point we came across the Dhamma. If we take all of us collectively, there is no stone we have left unturned, collectively. Right? There's probably someone here who's done medicine, and someone else who's done science or math, someone else who's done law, someone else a teacher. Now, many of you are mothers and fathers. Some of you would be bankers, others would be economists, others would be physicists, others would be biochemists, others would be rocket scientists. We've done the lot. Then there'll be vendors, and there'll be merchants, salesmen, politicians, perhaps, right? Teachers, and all sorts. We've done the lot all together, collectively. We've done everything under the sun, all in the effort to try and find the truth. But for some of you, this may be the first time you've actually got down on your knees, knelt down to show your respect to another human being. Perhaps in your cultures, in some of us, it may not be even something that we do towards our parents. But for some reason, as you come across the Buddha Sasana, you realize that I have found something I never even did through my mother, through my father. And that is the truth. Our parents, of course, they love us more than they love themselves. They love us like they love no other. But for all that love, they have not been able to show us how to love ourselves. That they weren't able to show us. Because if one loves oneself, then one must work towards their salvation, their liberation. And that is by freeing themselves from attachment. Because there is no other way to love oneself. There's no better way to love oneself. There's no more a sublime or a more noble way to love oneself than to free oneself from attachment. Because you all know what attachment does to you. So, in the Buddha Sasana, having come across the Noble Association, having come across the Mahasangha, today you have realized that truth. How does one free oneself from attachment, and that it is attachment that causes suffering? This is what your respect is meant towards. That we respect. That you are not blind followers. You are not just sheep that goes behind the shepherd. We respect that. I respect the fact that I can't just point you in any direction and you will just start blindly walking that way. I respect that. Because then I have no fear. You know, just imagine if you were all just blind followers, and I'd have to be very cautious about everything I say. And what if I lose my mind? I go crazy. Now? Then you're just going to blindly follow me. And then if I go and stand on the cliff of a hill, and then I jump, everyone comes behind me and they jump. That's dangerous, don't you think? But the fact that you are all wisely, intelligently, analytically contemplating on the truth, and you're walking this path because this makes sense to you, you're applying these principles in the lab of your life, you're testing it out, right? You're using your common sense, you're using your good knowledge, your wisdom, and it's making sense to you, and therefore you have become a student, not a follower. That deserves respect. So, in the same way that you respect the Mahasangha, I salute you. I want you to continue as good students, never as followers. Because a follower is just a led by the blind. But once you become a student, then you cannot be led astray. That's what's good, that's what we want. And that is what the Buddha wanted from all of us. As he always says, I can only show you the path, but you must walk yourself. If you are blind, you can't do that, can you? I show you the path, you walk yourself. If you were blind, what must the Buddha have had to do? Hold your hand and walk with you, if you were a blind follower. But because in the sasana you don't have blind followers, you have people who understand and comprehend the Dhamma and then take that journey themselves, now the Buddha can boldly say, I don't walk you to Nibbana. I show you where Nibbana is. Have you seen it? Oh yeah, right. Now on your way. You see, this is only possible because in the Buddha sasana, blind following is not the path. So I encourage that and I want you all to be like that for now and forever. And when you are like that, then respect, devotion and obeisance will arise in your mind. Rejoice in that. Rejoice in that, knowing to what it is we make this respect. To what it is we show this respect. Just as much as I rejoice, I want you to rejoice in the same. So when we bring our palms together in veneration of the Lord Buddha, these are some of the things that cross through my mind. I reflect on these things. I reflect on what a great teacher he was, to have taught us a journey, a path, shown us a destination that we can all walk ourselves. Just imagine if he had to be here to ferry us across. If the path that he taught us was one where he had to walk us, hold us by our hand, we'd have to have a Buddha here with us today. But he made us independent. He gave us independence. He gave us responsibility and he gave us accountability. He made us free. Now you're not even dependent on an individual. You're not even dependent on the Buddha. Because you are now dependent on the Dhamma, which is the path. Dhammo have rakkati dhammacari, not the Buddha. Once you are equipped with the Dhamma, now the Dhamma is your salvation. It helps you on your path from here till the end. So, to that greatness, to that thoughtfulness, to that wisdom, let us bring our palms together in veneration. May this veneration be to his holy name, he who is the greatest teacher we have ever seen. May this veneration be to his wisdom, to his compassion, to his kindness. And let us also make this an opportunity to renew our pledge of allegiance to the Noble Triple Gem, as we renew our oath to walk this journey till the end, till the very end.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Now that you're all equipped with the Dhamma, and day by day we equip ourselves even better with the Dhamma, we learn the Dhamma, we understand the Dhamma, and we have started applying the Dhamma into our lives, I want all of you to be able to look at every opportunity that comes your way as an opportunity. See, in life there are pessimists and optimists. Without the Dhamma, I can forgive you for being a pessimist in life, in various situations. Right? If you're going through a tough time, financially, socially, in whatever aspect, right? Family life's falling apart, people are not liking you very much, you know, your friends are leaving you, whatever, right? Your spouse is betraying you. These will be seen as difficulties. Because a pessimist is someone who always sees the difficulty in every opportunity. Whereas the optimist is someone who always sees the opportunity in every difficulty. If you have now equipped yourselves with the Dhamma, you must begin to see opportunities in every difficulty that comes your way. This is the right attitude to have. Not just because I say so, though. And it's not just because I give you a pat on the back and say, well done, sir. It has to be your attitude, and that should come from within. You know, when I say these things, I need you to ask yourselves, are you actually like that? Are you genuinely like that? Not just because I say so. So when I paint a picture of the right kind of attitude that one must have to get to Nibbana, I need all of you to ask yourselves that question. Am I that kind of person? Do I have that kind of attitude? Remember, I always say, a monk's attitude must come first. Monkhood comes later. Yeah. Whereas if you get the other way around, then usually monkhood doesn't last very long. The attitude is most important. If you have the attitude of a monk, now it doesn't matter too much that you are a pot plant. You know what a pot plant is? That was on Sunday in Rajagiri. Most people are like pot plants because when you want the sun, you put it out. Mostly people who live in flats and so on, yeah, they are pot plants because they can't grow plants in the soil. So there's no soil, there's no ground. So you have a pot plant. You put it out in the sun so that you get a bit of sun. But if you particularly live in a flat, then you don't get the sun from dawn to dusk. You only get it half of the day because you know, you're in a flat. And then when time is up, when there's no longer sunlight, you take it back in. And then next morning you put it out. That's how you deal with pot plants. But when you are in the community of the Mahasangha, now you no longer are a pot plant, you are always out in the sun. By sun, what do I mean here? Absolutely. And noble association. So you always have the Dhamma. But the majority of a lay community, they are like pot plants. That's why I tell the Rajagirians on Sunday mornings, you put the pot out in the sun. Right? Then you get some sunlight. And then Sunday around 11 o'clock, you take it back in. And then next Sunday, you put it out again. Pot plants. But the same cannot be said for you, because most of you spend your lives with the monastery. Most of you are here from, say, around Wednesday to Sunday, and then Monday, Tuesday. Some of you take time out. But the rest of you are here 7 days a week. So you get that sunlight all the time. But in any case, that is besides the point, in any case, to whatever extent you can apply yourselves in the Dhamma, ladies and gentlemen, I need you to have the right attitude, that's all. You know, even if it's a Sunday morning, you need to have the right attitude throughout the clock. Because it might quite be that Saturdays is the only day you have where you can put yourselves in the Dhamma. Sunday may be the only day you have to put yourselves in the Dhamma, but the rest of the time you're out working. You've got families to look after, you've got things to do, bills to pay, right? Duties, obligations, responsibilities and all that good stuff. But no matter what you're doing, I need you to have the right attitude. This is crucial. It really is. I wouldn't be going on about this if this wasn't so important. A monk's attitude is far more important than a robe and a shaved head. Honestly. You have to be a monk at home first, and then you can be a monk at the temple. Have you not seen people who haven't got the first part right? And then they try and do the second half, and it doesn't work out. It's incredibly difficult when it is that way around. When you put on robes first, and then you try to become someone who's fitting of a robe, it's incredibly difficult. People don't tend to last very long that way. We only have less than 30,000 monks in Sri Lanka. Did you know? Less than 30,000 monks in Sri Lanka. Every week, they have so many files in the offices of the secretaries of each Nikaya, each chapter, where monks come along and say, we want to disrobe and go back to our lay lives, because they didn't have the attitude of a monk. before they come into the sasana. See, this is the thing. These days, generally, you know, walking into monkhood is very simple. It's very easy to do. You just walk, go up to a temple and say, monk, venerable sir, I want to become a monk. Most temples, they don't have monks. Right? They lay bare. Right? They're going to ruins. So, of course, when you have a property to look after, now you need someone to look after that property. I mean, that is what it's become. It's become a property that needs looking after. You know, do you think I'm looking after the monastery? The monastery is looking after me. That's the truth. You get that? I'm not looking after this monastery. The monastery is looking after me. Now just imagine the day I had to be here to look after the monastery. So what did I do as a layperson? The same thing, didn't I? As a householder, I look after the house. I looked after my family. I looked after my wife. If I had children, I'd have looked after my children. But when I'm here, the monastery, not the buildings, the people who live in them, they look after me. I'm here for noble association just as much as a newcomer who's coming today. They're here for noble association. We both look for the same thing in the community that we are. But it is quite unfortunate. I don't know what the situation is in other countries, but certainly in our country, there are many temples. If you go to any village, there are many temples. Sometimes temples are the size of mansions. They have many buildings because they were meant to accommodate many people on the pursuit of their salvation. But unfortunately, somewhere down the line, putting in the right attitude into people's minds, that got lost. Monkhood has become easy now. Not being a monk, but becoming a monk. That's become very easy. All you have to do is go out to a Naikathero and request ordination. Most of the time, they'll say, okay, tomorrow morning, they'll set a time. No, honestly, the following morning. Just come back the following morning. Do you have your parents' consent? Yep. Right, well, go to the shop, get some robes and an alms bowl, and I'll see you here at 8:05. The auspicious time. Becoming a monk is one of the easiest things to do in this world. Because you're running away from responsibilities. Seems like that, doesn't it? All you have to do is just pull the plug. It looks like one of the easiest things to do. But being a monk, remaining a monk, oh, that's not easy. That's not easy if you don't have the right attitude. This is why, within all of you and people listening to this online, of course, we are always going on about come and join our ranks. Be part of us. Join this mission. Right, so that you can serve yourselves as you serve others. But the right attitude, that has to be instilled within everyone initially. Without that, it's going to be difficult. So what is that attitude then? This is what we talk about a lot of the time. Usually, at least, you know, certainly in the first half of these talks, right? This is what Guru Hamdra talks about, the first 2 to 3 hours of his talks. Having that right attitude. And part of that is to be optimistic in every difficulty. You see, if you didn't have an umbrella and it started raining, I can understand if you complained about it. Now you can be a pessimist. Oh God, it's going to rain again. What to do now? My finest, I'm dressed in my finest, it's my finest hat and my new shoes, and it's all going to get wet. Oh, it's okay if you are a pessimist then. That's like everyone else out there. But if you now have an umbrella, you no longer need to be a pessimist. You can be an optimist. Now you can put your umbrella out, bring your umbrella out, and look your finest with the umbrella. And then rain as much as it might. Who cares? It doesn't bother you. Because now you have the umbrella. In the same way, because, you know, when you have an umbrella, this is an opportunity to show off your umbrella, isn't it? I mean, you can't just walk around with your umbrella if it's not raining and if the sun is not out either. You know, cloudy day, not raining, the sun is not too too bright, then if you had an umbrella in your hand, people are going to like, you know, something wrong with you. But if you had a really nice umbrella, yeah, just imagine you had the finest umbrella, you know, it's a prized piece, it's exquisite, right? It's a wonderful umbrella, it's the best umbrella. Now, don't you want an opportunity to show it off? To show it off to people so that you can actually, people will praise you for it and you can be happy having that umbrella in your hand. Well, now you're going to look forward to rain. You're going to be happy now when it rains because you can show off your umbrella. See, in the same way, now that you have the Dhamma, if you do, I don't know, only you have the answer to this. If you have the Dhamma, then may problems come my way. That's what you should be able to say. That's what you should be able to think. You should invite problems. So when problems come your way, when difficulties come your way, you remain optimistic. You see opportunities in them. Opportunities to apply the Dhamma that you have learned. Yesterday someone was asking me in one of our teacher meetings. One of our Swaminathas was asking me, Swaminathas, when should I apply Anicca Dukkha and Anatta? Is it to every sight, to every sound, to every smell, every taste, every touch that comes to me? I said, No. You don't have to do so much. I said, you only have to apply it. When every sight that comes to you and you think it's Nitya Sukha Anatta, that's when you have to apply. Otherwise, don't bother. If you think something's pleasurable, in those instances, apply Anicca. If you think something's vexing you, in those instances, apply Anicca. Because once you become an Arahant, what is the point of applying Anicca Dukkha Anatta? Yeah? So if all that comes to you are sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, then why bother? It's like if I give you paracetamol, when do you take it? Every time you have a head. Huh? No, every time you have a head? Ache. Yes. That's when you take a paracetamol. The Dhamma is a medicine. You take it when you're ill. Not otherwise. Nisaranattaya na ghanattaya. It is only something to take you to your refuge, not something to carry with you as a bird. So, when you see something, you have sights come your way, sounds come your way, smell, taste and touch come your way, thoughts come your way, and the way you perceive them are as entities. If you perceive them as something pleasurable, if you perceive them as something that bothers you, annoys you, perturbs you, these are moments for a pessimist to think as a difficulty, but for an optimist to see as an opportunity. But how can you do that if you didn't have the Dhamma? So now, if you are someone who has the Dhamma, there cannot be difficulties in life for you now. There can only be opportunities. I can say this, whether that is true or not for you, only you know. Do you open your eyes in the morning, right, and be grateful for everything that comes towards you? You open the door, you walk out, and you look up at the sky. Rainy day. Oh, wonderful. Sunny day. Oh, wonderful. Gloomy day. Oh, wonderful. You see a rainbow out there. Oh, wonderful. You walk along the street, right? And a pretty lady walks past. Don't say it out loud. But what must you think? Wonderful. But don't say it out loud, okay? Especially if she's with someone. Could get in trouble. That would not be wonderful. But after she walks past, it's rained, right? So there's a puddle of water. There's a puddle of water just 5 yards ahead of you. And now you're walking just around it and a vehicle drives past. They don't care to slow down. Now what happens? You're on the way to the monastery, so you're clad in white. Now you top it all. Now, what used to be white is what now? White and brown. You look at yourself, and now what do you say? Wonderful. It all depends on whether you are an optimist or a pessimist. I say again, it's easy for me to say these things. And just because I say it, I need, you know, that's not us all done. Because, you know, saying it while you're here is fine. It's easy. Because, you know, you just have to imagine such a situation. It's an imaginary situation. And of course, you know, it's going to be easy. But I need you to actually check what you're like when you're out there. These moments will come to you. Right? Maybe if they see a monk, they might slow down. But, you know, as a member of the lay community, people might not bother. Sometimes they may not even spot you. But in these situations, I want you to ask yourselves, do you honestly look at those opportunities and welcome them all? Are you someone who can welcome all of God's gifts? This is a gift from God. As a driver walks past and he splashes water all over you, don't you think that's a gift from God? Who gives you everything? Who is the provider? God is the provider. Give or deny. Yeah. Remember what God is? We redefine God. Remember? Give or deny. Give or deny. What you have given, you get. What you have denied, you are denied. What does God do? He gives you. He gives you what? What you have given. What does he deny you? What you have denied. Of course, if you have given love, you get love. There's a young boy in our monastery, one of our Anagarika children, 14. Yes, just turned. So he's lost his mother when he was very young. I think when he was 5 or 6, he had lost his mother. And when I got to know this, so I called him and I said, Putar, so you lost your mother when you were very young, right? Yes. Okay, so how you managed to cope with that? So and so. I say, no, it's okay. I came to terms with it, you know, about a few years in. I said, okay. So you see, Putar, do you see why you lost your mother? I want you to think about this. And I was talking with this boy. I said, Putar, do you know why you lost your mother? I said, and he says, cancer, Swaminathan. No. That's why your mother lost her life. Why did you lose your mother? Not because of cancer. Not sure, Swaminathan. What do you mean? I said, well, to have mother, you have to have given mother. That's when you get mother. Yeah? So I said, from here on, what I want you to do is be a mother to everyone in this monastery. Do that. To all your fellow brothers, to all of the Swaminuhanses, to all of your little brothers in your noble hearts, to all of them, be a mother. Because if you do that, you will never be left motherless. God has taken your mother away from you because you hadn't given motherliness. So God takes mother from you. If you give motherliness, then God gives you mother. So that was around 6 months ago. So the other day I bumped into him and I said, how are you doing? He said, good, Swaminathan. What are you giving everyone? Motherliness. He remembers. See, God gives gifts all the time, right? It is up to us to understand that these are all gifts from God. God is always merciful. He is. He only gives us what we deserve. Never what we desire. You don't get what you desire, you get what you deserve, don't you? Because what is it you deserve? What you have? Given. Some people call it God, others call it karma. What matters what we call it? Ultimately, it's the same principle. Isn't it? You always only get what you've given. We call it karma. In other philosophies, in other religions, they call it God. So do we deny God? No. Because we accept the principle. Should we call it God? So what? Let's call it God. No problem. So whatever God gives us, we need to be able to look at it as a gift. So when someone gives you a gift, what do you say? When someone gives you a gift, what do you say? Thank you. Well done. Thank you. So when that driver drives past that puddle and there's water now splash all over your body, right? You were white before, now you are white and brown. Then what do you say? Thank you. I want you to think like this, and I want you to do like this. You don't have to say it out loud, right? So please understand the meaning behind these words, right? I'm not asking you to say this out loud. Right? So if someone walks past you and they throw something at you and they say, thank you. Don't do that. Don't do that. It's not about what you say. It's about your attitude, right? You need to be someone who is always grateful for whatever comes your way. Because there are all opportunities for you to apply the Dhamma. Remember this and understand this more than remember it, folks. To get to the ultimate destination that you're all wanting to get to, the more times you apply anicca, dukkha and anatta, the better. Yeah? If this is a cream and you have a rash on your skin, the more times you apply that, the better, because the sooner you're going to be healed. So now, if defilements are hidden within you, and you have to contemplate on anicca, dukkha and anatta, particularly when you have those defilements, so that you know, right, these are the defilements that I have, so here's where I need to attack, right? Isn't that a blessing, don't you think? I always instruct and advise and encourage my students to put themselves where things are tough, where things are difficult. I always tell them, never run away when a situation gets difficult. When you start to vex, never run away from those situations, because what if God doesn't give that gift again? What if that gift doesn't come again? What if the next time He decides to give you that gift is in another cup? Another yawn? What if that's when you get that gift again? Right? Now someone comes up to you and they accuse you of something you've never done. You've not done something like that, but they accuse you of being a liar. And you know for sure you haven't lied. I want you to be able to say, thank you. Thank you for that. People think you're crazy. That's why I say, don't say it out loud. What you should be saying is, I'm sorry. I'm sorry you feel that way. Yeah, remember we talked about this a few weeks ago. If ever someone's upset with you, just say sorry. By saying sorry, you're not admitting guilt. Because some will have a problem with that. And if you say sorry and you admit guilt, now you're the guilty party. No. I'm saying you can say sorry that they feel that way, can't you? Aren't you really? Someone's furious, right? And they're having a go at you. Aren't you sorry that they feel that way? Aren't you? As good Buddhists, as practitioners of the Dhamma, aren't you sorry that they feel that way? Of course you are. That's why you want to do something about it, right? That's why you have become the right kind of people to mess with. Remember the old servants? Yes? Yes. We are the right kind of people for others to mess with. That's why we say, mess with me. We don't say, don't mess with me. It's good to mess with me. Is it not good to mess with the great elder Sariputta? Of course. That's the best kind of people to mess with. Because even if you bump into them by mistake, only good will happen to you. Walk up to the Buddha and start accusing him. Only good will happen to you. Because he will listen to everything you say, and then on the way back he'll tell you, sister, only you and I know the truth behind it. The right kind of people to mess with. You know, nothing wrong comes out of messing with people like that. Yeah, of course. You know, you might earn demerit by, you know, having evil thoughts towards the great elders and so on. But ultimately, if you're going to mess with someone, mess with an arahant. Because they will make sure that every opportunity there is, because they see all opportunities. They see all situations as opportunities. And it's to your advantage to be among people like that. You know, these are the really positive people. They are truly always positive. Don't you like to be around a positive thinker? Someone who always takes a positive attitude to life. Right? You know, they're just always so buzzing with energy. So positive. No matter what comes their way, they always see the glass is half full. They always say, well, you know, we can turn it around. We can do something about this. They're always having a positive attitude to life. Rahatanvans is always like that. Because all they see are opportunities to do something about it. In every difficulty, they spot an opportunity. I need all of you to be that way. That's why I say, when you know, stuff happens, be someone who can, from the bottom of your heart, actually say thank you. You're buttoning yourself up, getting ready to work, and the button comes off. Right? Now, without the Dhamma, what do? You start swearing. Then your friend starts flowing. Yeah? What must you actually be saying? Thank you. Thank God. Because here is an opportunity to apply the Dhamma. If you're vexed, it's an opportunity to apply the Dhamma. Someone takes something, you know, they've promised to be there on time and they haven't turned up. And now you're waiting. Now you're getting anxious, you're getting nervous, right? Thank them for not turning up on time. Normally, what do you say when someone turns up and they're tardy, they're late? What do you say? Hey, you know what? I've been waiting here for the last 15 minutes. Why do you do that? Why can't you just turn up on time? But first of all, in your mind, you have to be able to say thank you. Because God has given you a gift. You know, it's not a late man. That's not what's happened. What's happened is an opportunity for you to check yourself. That is what has happened. I really, really, really want you all to be able to look at situations in this way. You make a request and it's denied. You go to your teacher and ask for something and they say no. Thank them. For saying no, just as much as you thank them for saying yes. Normally, people tend to say thank you when they can get what they want, right? But what about when they don't get what they want? They don't tend to say thank you. They just tend to turn around and walk away, not feeling so grateful. It's funny how, you know, people, when they write letters and so on, they always say, I'll be very grateful if you do this, that, and the other. So what that means is, if you don't do it, I'm not very grateful. If you do it for me, I'm grateful. Otherwise, nah. You've got to be grateful for everything. Now, I hope you're beginning to see how you can be grateful for everything. On a sunny day, be grateful that it's a sunny day. On a rainy day, be grateful that it's a rainy day. On a gloomy day, be grateful that it's a gloomy day. On a hot day, what about when it's a hot day? Oh, they are the worst, aren't they? Hot days, right? 28, 29, you know, in the European part of the world, that's hot. But over here, 34, 35, 36, going 37, that's a hot day. Can you look up at the sky and go, thank you, God? Be grateful that it's a hot day. It's a gift from God. Because, you know, if it vexes you one bit, aren't you glad when you go, when you walk up to the MRI scanner, they do an MRI scan, or the X-ray machine, they do an X-ray, right? And they give you a report. Aren't you glad when you get your blood checked and they say you got high cholesterol, you got high this, you got high that, you got high blood sugar? Aren't you glad when they give you that report? What do you say when you get that report? You say thank you, right? Why do you say thank you? Exactly. What have they helped you figure out? Something's wrong with you that you need to do something about. That's why you pay for it. Don't you? When you get your MRI scan and they find there's a lump somewhere in your body, do you not pay them now? You only pay them if it's clear. Huh? Don't you pay them now? In fact, if they said, you know, there's a lump somewhere in your body and I'll tell you if you pay double, wouldn't you pay double? So say you go to get your MRI, right? You pay your fee, They say 5,000. They say, all right, we've done the MRI. There's a lump somewhere in your body, but to tell you where that is, you have to pay another 5,000. Would you or wouldn't you? Would you or wouldn't you? You would. Why would you do that? Because what does that help you figure? Where something's wrong and what's wrong with you? So when you pay that another extra, you pay the other 5,000, they give you the report, don't you say thank you? After you already paid them 10,000, you still say thank you. Because they've helped you figure out that there's a problem with you. So in the same way, when someone comes up to you, says something, does something that annoys you, that bothers you, you don't have to say this out loud. What I want you to have is the attitude whereby you only receive it and you extend out to them gratefulness and gratitude. And you can say, thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you. Thanks to you, I have been able to spot that there's a problem with me. When you take your car to the garage, and as you turn your vehicle, it makes a funny noise. You take the car to the garage, the mechanic, they examine your car and they say there's something wrong with it and we have figured out what it is. Right? Then don't you say thank you? Because you're grateful that they have spotted the problem. In your life, you will always come across people who will come up to you. They may seem like annoying people. They will. Without the Dhamma, they'll seem like annoying people to you. Whenever you have said, you know, that guy is so annoying. No, he's not annoying. He's very helpful. He has shown you that you are someone who gets annoyed. See, that's the silver lining. I need you all to be able to spot that silver lining. Then you are grateful. Immediately you jump from ungratefulness to gratefulness. If you see that dark cloud, oh God, you see the silver lining, now you're grateful. I invite you, I encourage you all, adopt that mindset, adopt that attitude. If you don't have it, take it on. If you have it, develop it. Become more like that. That is a monk's attitude. A monk is always happy. No matter what comes his way. I don't mean a monk is always, you know, a monk never vexes. An arahant doesn't vex. But a monk is someone who vexes, but he's grateful that there are opportunities that have helped him figure out that there are problems in his life, concerns, things that bother him, things that annoy him. So, you know, there will be some among you who still live with their children. If you live with your children might still, from time to time, annoy you. They'll bother you. They'll take away your peace. You know, they'll make you angry. Be glad that you have someone at home who helps you check your work, who helps you check that you have understood the principles of the Dhamma. Be glad that you have someone like that. So that attitude, let's make sure that we always have with us, because that is the monk's attitude that you need even before you become a monk. Does that make sense to everyone? Right? So finally, remember, it's easy for me to say, I need you to do it. How do you get better at it? By practicing it. So I don't think, you know, it's quite possible you get back home today, right, and the dishes haven't been done, the dog hasn't been taken out, right, the litter is still in the bins have not been emptied, right, the house has not been swept, the clothes are still on the clothesline and it's rained and it was dry when you left, but now no one's took it in, so it's all wet again. Now you have to do that, and you know tomorrow someone has to go to work and they haven't ironed the clothes, right? All of this is possible. No one's vacuumed the carpets, they haven't swept the floor, they haven't fed the dog, right? They haven't cooked, right? You expected the other person to do it, but they haven't done it. Then the maid hasn't turned up either. And you have a flat tire to top it all, right? So these things will happen to you. It might be when things go wrong like this, you feel like, why me? My question is, why not? Who else? Who else do you want these things to happen to? If you are someone who wants to practice the Dhamma, okay? If you are someone who wants to practice the Dhamma, and you can practice the Dhamma when you know you're vexing. You know, you can practice the Dhamma when you know what your problems are, then who else must these things happen to you? Happen to? Your neighbor. Your neighbor's not practicing the Dhamma. So why should they happen to them? In fact, don't you? You should be someone who wishes that all the problems my neighbor has, I wish they happened to me, and not my neighbor. I say there's a jackfruit tree on your side of the fence, right? But the fruit is hanging over to the other side. And there's a roof just underneath. So the fruit fell, and it fell on their roof, and now their roof is broken. And it rained. And now the house is wet. There was property in there. It's all wet, and it's in ruins. Now, who should you wish this should have happened to? Yeah. Because if you did, you are someone now who can say, thank you. Because what has happened is simply a vipaka process. It's just a vipaka. Vipakas don't bother you. Vipakas don't annoy you. But it is a vipaka that showed you that you can still be bothered. You can still be annoyed. You can still be angry. And for that, be grateful, because now you have the Dhamma. If you are someone who does not have the Dhamma, I agree. Let's try and make sure that bad things don't come your way. Because if they do, then, you know, that brings out a really bad side of you. That brings out the devil in you. Remember the old days when things used to bring out the devil in you? Still remember that? Huh? Doesn't make you proud today, does it? When it used to bring out the devil in you? But today, I don't believe that any of you in this room go that far. There may be times where you get a little bit annoyed, a little bit upset, a little bit bothered, but today I think you've all come to a point where you are in control of your emotions, of your feelings. I think so. Right? Correct me if I'm wrong. I think you have come to a point where you're in control. You know when you're angry. At least you know when you're angry. At least you know when you have lustful thoughts. You know, right? Yeah, I've got these thoughts now I'm dealing with. You know when you're feeling egotistical. You know when you're feeling bothered by someone. Right? You know when you're having thoughts that you shouldn't have. At least you know that. So it's all in your radar now. You're able to sense them. You're able to pick them up. And now, these are all opportunities, because you are an optimistic individual. So I hope that is the case. And be grateful for everything that God throws at you. Right, now I have another question to ask you then. In fact, I want you to do something for me. We're going to try and do something practical today, okay? I want you all Do you need chairs at the back? I want you all to imagine an elephant. Can you do that for me? Have you all seen elephants? Good. Now imagine an elephant. Okay? Right. Now reach out and touch it. No, literally, reach out and touch it. Some of you are trying to put your arm out this way. Others are staying put. Where is that elephant? So I ask you to imagine an elephant. Now, then I ask you to reach out and touch it. Yeah? But why didn't you go this way? Huh? Now I saw some of you putting your arm out this way. Why didn't you go this way? Or that way? Or behind you? Or above you? Why did you go this way? No, but for most of you, you just stayed put. Right? You didn't extend your arms. You just stayed like that. Because I asked you to reach out and touch something that I asked you to imagine. Yeah? Excuse me. So you know that when I ask you to imagine something, of course there's a mental picture in your mind. So this elephant of yours, it might have a long trunk. It might have tusks. It might have a long tail. It's certainly got four legs, hopefully, right? And it's a big animal, right? You imagine this elephant. So when I ask you to reach out and touch this elephant, most of you don't bother. Right, now I want you to do something else. I want you to see the chair that you are sat on. Look at it. Look at the chair that you are sat on. Okay, now touch it. All right. You touched your chair, didn't you? Yeah? Yeah. Okay. Relax. You're crazy. Honestly, you're crazy. Would you believe me if I told you that the elephant you imagine and the chair that you see that you're sat on are both equally virtual? Just as much as you cannot touch the elephant that you have imagined, you cannot touch the chair that you see. Now let's try and unravel this, okay? Because I know at first sight you're like, what? Samina said. You think we are crazy, Samina said, you're crazy. See, the problem here is, when you look at an object, such as the chair that you are sat on, you think you are seeing the object. So this pen that I have here, you think you are seeing the pen. In fact, you are thinking that what you are seeing is the pen. So it's a way that we construct these sentences, because when you, depending on where you put the subject and the verb, different meanings can surface, right? So let me try and be careful with what I want to say. You see a pen. You think that this is the pen that you see. Don't you? Just like the chair that you're sat on. You think, don't you? Don't you think that? Don't you think that that is the chair that you are sat on? You see the chair that you are sat on. Yeah? Okay. But when I ask you to imagine an elephant, now in your mind you have an elephant. But when I ask you to reach out and touch it, you don't bother. That elephant you don't bother, but the pen, you actually reach out and touch it. If it's a chair, you reach out and touch that. Somehow, you think that the chair that you see is there, but the elephant that you see is not there. Isn't that why you didn't reach out to touch it? I'll say that again, okay? Let's take our time. When I ask you to imagine an elephant, you had an imaginary elephant. And I asked you to touch that elephant, you didn't bother. Now, you know, even when you did like that, you know that that's not the real elephant, right? You're trying to imagine that it's in front of you, and then you extended your arm. But most of you didn't even bother because you know that's an imaginary elephant. How can you touch an imaginary elephant? Is what you're thinking. But you now, just because you can't touch that elephant, didn't that elephant come to your mind in full detail? Right, the wrinkly skin of an elephant, the coarse wrinkly skin, right, and the trunk and the tusks if it had one, right, and the tail. Right? It's in high definition, is it not? And now I'll ask you another question. What color is that elephant? See? You're even giving me the color of the elephant. Okay, what color are his tusks? White. Ivory. See? You're even giving me the color of the elephant's tusks. Now imagine that elephant eating some bananas. Okay? What's the elephant doing now? Eating bananas. What color are those bananas? How do you do that? My problem is not that. So of course, when you imagine this elephant, the elephant is of This is, you know, you didn't imagine a black and white elephant. You imagined a full color elephant. Provided you have all seen color in your lives, you were not born colorblind, and you saw the elephant when you, you know, even if you later on developed colorblindness, if you saw the elephant before you went colorblind, now you know that an elephant is of this color. Right? If you've seen bananas the same, then you know the bananas are yellow. So provided you've seen bananas in color and an elephant in color, now when I say imagine an elephant eating bananas, you see a black elephant eating yellow bananas. Okay, thank you. So you imagine an elephant eating bananas. Once again, get that picture in your mind again. Elephant eating bananas. You have it in your mind now, everyone? Okay, all right. But you don't bother reach out and touch it, do you? You don't bother to reach out and touch it because it's only an imagination. So this picture of the elephant is in your mind. Don't you know that? Of course we know that. That's why we don't reach out to touch it. But then I say, the chair that you saw, or the chair that you see, touch it. What did you do? You touched it. You physically extended your arm and you touched it. Did you actually touch the chair that you saw? No. Why do we say no? Because, now let's try and understand this. I'm trying to get to a point where you understand the whole world is simply a manifestation. Causes that manifest mental images. So when I asked you to touch the chair that you saw, you extended your arm and you held the plastic that you sat on. Because you think the chair that you see is the chair that's over there. But the elephant you think is not out there. Because that is an imaginary elephant you think. You think it's a mental elephant, but this is a physical chair. Now, how do you know that there's a chair? How do you know that the chair that you see in your mind is over there? How do you know that? Why do you think that? Because when you extend your arm and you touch it, yeah, when you touch it, your perception tells you, or actually rather fools you, that the image that you have seen is actually on this, belongs to this object. The image that you see actually belongs to this object. That is what your perception does. You see, vijnana is a wizard. It's an illusionist. It is capable of creating illusions. Look at what this illusion does. You see a chair, or in this case a pen, and when I ask you to touch it, you extend your arm and you hold this pen like this. Because you think that this is the pen that you see. Seeing is not something you can do with this. Would you believe me? Seeing is not something you can do with this. Seeing is something that is purely mental. It's a mental image, just like the elephant that you imagined. But somehow you feel that the imaginary elephant was an imaginary elephant. It's not really there, but the chair or the pen that you see is actually out here. You feel that way. You perceive that way. That's because your mind projects the mental image onto this object. This is what your five senses enable you to do. Okay? Your five senses extend your mental images into the outside world. What your eyes do is help you to extend that mental image of this pen onto the outside world. Now, if you closed your eyes, where's this pen? If you closed your eyes, where is this pen? In your mind, yes. Now, see, I want you all to look at this pen for a second. Okay? Now close your eyes. Now, where's the pen? When I showed you the pen, where was the pen? In my hand. It was in my hand, wasn't it? Okay, now I ask you to close your eyes. Now where's the pen? Still it's in my hand. Well, open your eyes now. It's not. I'm trying to prove a point here. Right? Let's try that again. And don't open your eyes until I tell so. Right? Play along with me. So I'm trying to help you understand this concept, right? Okay. Open your eyes. What is this? A pen. And where is this pen? In my hand. Okay? Close your eyes. Where is the pen? In my hand. Open your eyes. It's not. But what did your mind tell you? That the pen was in my hand. Yeah? But when you open your eyes, now where's the pen? You don't know now where the pen is. But if you close your eyes again, you can still recollect that image of me holding the pen in my hand, can't you? But when you open your eyes again, now the pen is not here. See, so tell me then, what do your eyes let you do? Help you do, rather. It helps you to project that mental image onto the outside world. Just as much as it brings in data from the outside world, it also helps you to project the mental picture onto the outside world. It's like taking in data, you process, you create information, and then you present that information outside. This your eyes help you do. And the same goes for touch. When you extended your arm and you touched that chair, you could get an idea of the distance between you and the chair. Couldn't you? Now just imagine, unbeknown to you, we somehow severed the nerve. Right? We sliced the nerve that goes from your fingertips to your brain. And then we did a bypass. Okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to take this gentleman's nerve that goes from his head to his fingertips and connect it to the Swaminathan right at the back of the room. Now, he doesn't know this. He doesn't know that we've done this. Understand? You are much prettier than this, sir. Okay. Okay, this is a chair, that's a stool. We have blindfolded this man. Now we ask this man to touch this chair. Right? Actually, let's give him sight first. So he sees that he's touching the chair. How's he touching the chair? With his fingers. Okay? Then we ask him to, we will re-blindfold him. Now remember here, there's a nerve. This is the chair. This is the finger. And this is the man's brain. There's a nerve cell that carries this signal from the brain to the nerve. Yeah? Otherwise they wouldn't be able to sense it. What we're going to do is, after we blindfold this gentleman, we're going to do a bypass. We're going to cut this. And then we're going to connect it to this. Right? The distance between the two of them is 200 meters. Okay? Now, we ask this man to now touch the object that's here. This is just a stool. It's not even a chair. Now he touches the stool. When this man touches the stool, what does he think he's doing? He's touching the chair. And at this point, remember he's blindfolded. If we ask him the question, where is this chair? This is half a meter. If we ask him, where is the chair that you're touching right now, what would he say? In front of him. And then we ask him to open his eyes. And then he sees that, you know, his finger has been disconnected. And there's a wire that's going from him to this man 200 meters away. Now what's he going to be? Well, the word is shocked. But he feels no difference between these two touches. In fact, like I said, when we did this experiment, he's going to think that when he puts his finger on the stool, he's going to think that it is I who's touching the chair. Because of this, the reason for this is, he knows as a fact how long his arm is. You know how long your arm is. So as when you extend your arm and you touch something, you know that that is how far it is to you. Because you know how long your arm is. In other words, you know how long this nerve cell is. Or even if you didn't understand nerves and this is how the body works and you have a nervous system, right? As young people, we don't understand this. But growing up, we acquire this knowledge. So even if you didn't understand that, you know that your arm is this long. You may not know how long it is in terms of a number, whether it's, 20 centimeters, 30 centimeters, 50, 60 centimeters. You may not know that, but you know that it is about this long, even if you couldn't give it a number. It's this long. So when you touch something, even when you have your eyes closed, you know that it is so far from you, don't you? But in this case, are you right? Because we just severed this nerve, we did a bypass, and now this man is another man, another finger. He's touching another object, not the same object even, but he thinks he's touching this object, which is just in front of him. So, when you open your eyes, what does the sense of sight and the sense of touch actually let him do? What does it offer him? The ability to project what he perceives onto the outside world. So, even when he's blindfolded, if we ask him to reach out and touch something, he would be able to say how far it is from him. Now, can't you do that? If I ask you to close your eyes, and I ask you to extend your arm and touch something, okay? Aren't you able to say how far it is from you? But you're not even looking at it. How do you know how far it is from you? Because you know how long your arm is. You know this fact. It's a piece of information that's in your mind. Remember, it's a piece of information in your mind. It's actually in your memory. It's in your memory how long your arm is. So therefore, when that sensation of touch is created in your mind, when you perceive that sensation, your mind has to do extra processing. Go into memory and bring back a piece of data that tells you how long your arm is, and then work out that together, and then you have to overlay that sensory perception onto this piece of data, and then be able to say, this object is half a meter away from me. Remember, this is mental processing. You have to do this mental processing every time you're touching something. Now, you can all sense the feet, you can sense the flow under your feet, right? Yeah? How do you know that the flow is not above you? How do you know that the flow is not above you and it's under your feet? Try and understand exactly what I'm trying to get across to you here. See, your mind is only sensing perception. Your mind is simply perceiving a touch. That's all your mind is perceiving. It's just a touch. How do you know that this is the floor that I'm touching? And that it is my feet that's touching the floor and not my hand touching something else? Memory, yeah. It's memory and mental processing. From memory, you're bringing in pieces of data. This touch, because you see, your toe or your feet touching the floor has a certain sensation. Okay? Your hand touching a desk has a certain sensation. These sensations are in your memory banks. These are in your memory banks. So when a particular kind of touch is perceived, you have to dip into memory and check what that memory or what that touch is. Is this the floor? Is this the desk? Are these my clothes around my body? Is this the hat on my head? Is this my hair on my head? Is this a part of my body? Now, here's another question for you. Can you perceive how far your lungs are from each other? Can you? Visually, because you've studied the lungs, you may know the answer to this question. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about knowledge. I'm talking about, can you perceive how far your lungs are from each other? No. But if you have your two fingers rubbing against each other, right? Can't you perceive how close they are to each other when you're doing this? You can. The reason you can't perceive how far your lungs are from each other is because you don't have the sense of touch coming from your lungs. Because internally, the sensation of touch, it's not there. You have pressure sensors maybe, so that when you have, you know, ulcers and so on, you start to pick up, right? Or tumors and so on, you start to pick up. But that's how you sense pain. But the sense of touch is not there. Pressure sensors maybe, but not touch sensors. So how long is your long intestine? Perceive it and tell me. Now, you know, is it not thanks to our science teachers? We know that our intestines are around 20 feet long or something like that. 20? Something. 6 meters, eh? 6 meters. Right? So here's your esophagus, your stomach, right? And then you have your small intestines doing all that. And then you have the big, large intestine going around this, right? And then your food excrement. This is your mouth and so on, right? Now, when we learned this for science, that's when we knew that the large intestine took this shape. When we learned this for science, that's when we knew that the small intestines were packed and compact in your lower abdomen. Right? That's when you knew that the esophagus was like this. But your tongue, you can sense that. Could you sense the shape of your stomach? You can't. Because you don't have touch receptors here. You don't have touch receptors. See, we have no idea as to how long our intestines are. Because you don't have touch receptors inside. So therefore, you're not able to sense food as it passes down your intestines. So therefore, you know, if for example, you could sense touch in each part of these intestines, you could, you know, if say there's a blob of food, you could sense it as it passes along. You would be able to sense it, but it doesn't work like that. So therefore, you can't tell how far this is from this. For instance, you don't have any perception of what that distance is. But when you reach out and touch an object, you know how long your arm is because you've seen your arm. You've seen that. Because you've seen that, you know how long your arm is. So when you touch something, you know that it is this distance away from you. Now, is this coming with the touch itself, or Don't you think that more processing needs to happen, more information needs to be used to make this judgment? You need more information. That information has to come from your mental processing. So you see, the moment you touch something, that I said we were talking about the flow being under your feet, right? When you sense the flow under your feet, you know almost immediately that this is the flow, and it is so far from you. Let's say you are up here. If you are up here, then you know that the flow is so far from you. Okay? So this is all to do with not just the mere sensory perception, but also your memory, knowledge that you have all coming together. As I said, data, pieces of data coming together to create this new piece of information. So your brain is a supercomputer, actually not your brain. Your brain together with the mind is doing all this computation so that you are able to get a very vivid picture of the world that you live in. So I come back to the question I asked you earlier then. When you imagine that elephant, you all fully and completely accepted the fact that it's an imaginary elephant and that elephant does not exist outside. Didn't you? That's why you didn't bother reaching your arm out to try and hold it or touch it. When you imagine the elephant. But when I asked you to look at this pen, or the chair in your case, If I asked you to reach out and touch this pen, you would actually make an effort because you think that the image that you see of the pen is that of this object. Which object? This object. But the elephant? Which object? Which object? There you go. You know that that elephant has no object. Yeah? You know that that picture, the mental picture of the elephant that you imagine has no object. But with this, when you see this pen, you think the image of the pen has an object. In other words, it belongs to this object. Are you right or wrong? You're wrong. You're wrong because mental images are purely mental. But what your senses do, your eyes along with the sense of touch do, is they project that mental image onto the outside world. See, your eyes are a fantastic piece of equipment that are capable of doing that. Because light rays work in that way. When you open your eyes, your light rays don't only bring light in through your eyes, but your mind does the computation inside and it works out the distance between those two things. But here's the funny thing. The dimension of distance that you gauge from sight is purely fictional. Because actually what you're seeing is a two-dimensional image. There is not a third dimension that you can see. Now, I know that sounds really bizarre, but let me try and prove it to you in a way I can. Right. Look, I want you all to look at this pen for a second. Okay? You tell me what I'm doing right now with this pen. What am I doing? Moving it to me and away from you. How do you know that? Yeah, exactly. But how do you know that? You know it because, you know, all you can see are colors. If all the mind can perceive are colors, how does it perceive the sense of depth? Computes. This is getting smaller, isn't it? Is the object getting smaller? What's getting smaller? The image is getting smaller. Is it actually getting smaller? Is the object getting smaller? No. But here's what you know. You know from knowledge that if something is smaller, it must be further away. Remember, I don't know if you recall this, but the first time I saw an airplane in the sky, I had to ask this question. How come airplanes are so small? I actually asked this question. I remember. How come airplanes are so small? Because I had no knowledge that when an object is so far away, it appears small. So that was a piece of information that I had to acquire. Because I'd never seen a plane in the sky. I mean, I'd seen other things. I'd seen birds in the sky. I'd seen the sun. I'd seen the moon. I'd seen those things. But I'd not seen a plane in the sky. We acquired that knowledge. And then we learned that when things are near, they appear big. When things are further away, they appear small. Now, if you turn it around on its head, when things are bigger, they are closer to us. When things are smaller, they are further away from us. Not literally. We think they are further away from us. We think they are closer to us. This is why you have visual illusions. Haven't you seen those? I'm sure you have. Most of you will have. Next time I'll bring a few of free so you can see this yourselves. Two lines which are similar in length. One looks longer than the other. Now I know this is a very crude drawing. One is probably longer than the other, literally, but your mind perceives one to be longer than the other. It looks like which one's longer. In fact, let me actually do it for you. Let's see if this will work, okay? I can't promise anything. Let's try. Now, these lines are roughly the same. But doesn't one appear longer than the other? Which one appears longer? The one above. But you know that I drew both of them using the same object, right, as a measure of distance, but one looks longer than the other. This is because of the way that the mind perceives it. You know, where is that original information coming from? It's not coming from the object. This object, this line and this line are exactly the same length. So it's not coming from the object. But you perceive one to be longer than the other because of the way that the mind computes this information. These arrows. This arrow is pointing away, these arrows are pointing towards each other. That's the difference. So your mind uses this information and it does further computation and then gives you the impression that one is longer than the other. There are plenty of visual illusions like this. I'll bring a few in the next day to show you some. Now, then the reason that you think that this is closer to you and this is further away from you is because this image that is created in your mind is smaller. The image is smaller. What about the object? Has that reduced in size? No. Now, you might wonder, where are we going with all this? So what's the deal? Why are we even talking about this? What we are talking about here is simply this. What you are seeing is an image. It is not an image that belongs to the object. What you are seeing is simply an image. Like the image that you saw when I asked you to imagine the elephant. Elephant eating bananas. To which object does that image belong? Can you show it to me? Is it in this room? No. So you know well and truly that that image does not belong to an object. Okay? Sorry. But when I ask you to look at this pen, you feel and you think and you know that the image that you see belongs to this object. Because you think that the image belongs to the object, here's the problem. If you like the image, okay? If you like the image, in other words, if you like what you see, you will also like the object. Because you think that the image belongs to the object. Let's go back to the elephant once again. If you like that elephant, what are you going to do? What are you going to take home with you? Can you take an elephant with you? Because there's no elephant here. It's an imaginary elephant. But if you like this image, what are you going to do? You're going to take this pen home with you. Because you believe that that image belongs to this object. But what I'm trying to explain to you here, and I hope that you're realizing, is that that image of an elephant is by and large the same as the image that you see when you see this pen. I don't mean that the elephant and the pen are the same image, but they're both images in their own regard. In that way, they're both identical. They're both images. Images are created in the mind. They are not to do with objects. So these objects, they don't have images. You know, they're not meant to be seen. Do you know that? Do you think this is to be seen? I don't know if you understand the context in which I mean this. Do you think this is something to be seen? Now, just imagine. Okay. All right. Say you're trying to take a picture. You're trying to take a picture of someone with your camera. And someone else is standing in front of them. Two other people are standing in front of them. You want to take a picture of this person. Which person? This person. These people are getting in the way. Now you want to take a picture of this person. What are you going to ask these two people to do? Move out of the way. Why? Because I want to see this person so I can take a picture of them. But well, hold on. Things are not meant to be seen. I'm talking about the object. the, you know, God didn't create objects into this world so that you could see them. Objects are merely objects. They're not things to be seen. But we have this impression that if it's an object, then it is something that we have a right to see. That's why you ask these two people to step away so I can see the object. Who says that an object is something to be seen? Because if an object was something to be seen, it would have something about it that would give you the ability to see it. But it doesn't. If an object was supposed to be seen, it would have color. Because color is what you see, right? Do you see anything about color? No. So if an object was something to be seen, then wouldn't God create an object with color in it? If it was supposed to be seen? He would have. But it's not to be seen. That's why he didn't put color into it. That's why objects have no color. So what you see is an interpretation of radiating light waves or electromagnetic waves. Your eyes are able to be stimulated by a certain frequency of energy which you perceive in your mind as color. Now, if color is merely something that the mind perceives, that is a relationship that the mind has with objects, nothing to do with objects. Let me give you an analogy to help you better understand this. Let's just say there was an apple here. There's an apple here, okay? It's an artificial apple, a plastic apple. It's meant to be as an item of decoration. So the apple has been put here as a decoration, okay? Someone walks into this room and they're hungry. Now, they don't know that this is a plastic apple. What would they do? If they're hungry, they might try and bite, take a bite, try to eat this. Now, when they realize, when they try to bite it, what are they going to realize? That it's a plastic apple. Now, what they might do is they might start shouting, getting angry with the person who put the apple there and say, why did you put the plastic apple here? I ate it. I tried to eat it. How dare you put a plastic apple here? Now, what do we have to say to that person in response to that? I didn't put it there for you to eat it. Yeah? I didn't put it there for you to eat it. Who asked you to eat it? It was merely there as a decoration. So why did you bother eating it? Wouldn't you say that? You would, right? So what you're saying is this was not meant to be here as an item of food for you to eat. It was simply there as an item of decoration. So why did you bother eating it? Whose fault was that? Your fault for thinking that this was an edible object. It wasn't. It was merely for decoration. Now tell me what you know about objects in the same way. Are objects meant to be seen? Are objects meant to be seen? No. If objects were meant to be seen, in other words, if these things were meant to be eaten, I wouldn't have plastic apples here, would I? I'd have the real apple. Now at home, you know, for some of you, if you have a dining table, I know you have a dining, not if you have a dining, you have a dining table at home. I'm thinking, you know, in my world, we don't have a dining table. Apologies. So at home, you have a dining table, and on that dining table, now, I remember from when I was a layperson, we used to have some fruits always in the middle of the dining table. So that, you know, the greedy bugger I was, whenever I was hungry, I'd munch an apple or take an orange or something. Right? And it just felt like a nice thing to do. So that if anyone was hungry, as they walked past the dining room, they could pick up and have an apple. An apple a day keeps, you know, kept the doctor away. So all that. Right? So now, if those were plastic, if they were meant to be eaten, we would never put a plastic apple there, would we? They'd be real apples. Yeah? So, but if you want to decorate the dining room and, you know, make it look nice, then we'd have plastic apples. So those apples would never not be eaten. They'd be there for decoration. Now, if they were plastic apples and someone came and tried to take a bite and they went, what's this? This is, how can you eat this stuff? Why do you put this here? The answer to that would be, No, why did you bother eating? Because these were not to be eaten. This is merely for decoration. So then you'd say, oh, don't accuse me of putting plastic apples here because they were not to be eaten. It was simply for decoration. If they were to be eaten, what would I put there? A real apple. So, if objects were meant to be seen, what would they have in them? Color. If objects were meant to be seen, they'd have color in them. Do objects have color in them? They don't. They have pigments. The truth is, right, pigments are also not there for you to see color. Pigments are not in objects so that you can see color. They don't care about you. Who are you? Who are you? Well, you know, you think someone came and put pigments in objects so that you could see them? No one gives a damn about who you are and what you want to do. No one cares. All pigments do is they are sensitive to energy. What pigments do is they absorb energy and some of that energy they give out so that you can see color. Huh? So you can see them? No. Yeah, there's no such relationship between an object and you. There is no such relationship. Now, you know, when, just imagine a world where there are no human beings at all, no sentient beings. Okay? Wouldn't there still be objects in this world? Before any kind of life form, wouldn't there still be objects in this world? Wouldn't they have pigments? They'd still have pigments. Why? So that you can see them? No. No. Now, I know, right? It is the mind that creates the world, and therefore the mind puts into these objects. When the mind creates the objects, it creates the objects in a way that it can see them. You know, that is besides the point, right? That's why in the Arupa worlds, you don't have objects that can be seen. You don't have objects full stop in the Arupa worlds, because it is the mind that creates that world. Even the sensual world, the mind creates the world. In the Rupa worlds, the mind creates the world. Okay, so we create the environment in which we go and live. But I'm talking about after the fact, not about the creation part. I'm not talking about Genesis. I'm talking about after the fact. After the fact, these objects, if you were to say that these objects are there so that I can see them, that is wrong. If these were there so that you can see them, these objects should have color in them. Because color is what you see. But if you remember from our previous conversation, last week's conversation, you should be glad that these objects don't have color, because if they did, you wouldn't be able to see them. Huh? Come again? You have to be glad that these objects actually don't have color. If they did, you wouldn't be able to see them. I'm mimicking you. What? You can't see colors. Your eyes aren't sensitive to colors. Your eyes aren't sensitive to colors. You have rods and cones in the back of your eyes. They're not sensitive to colors. They're sensitive to electromagnetic waves. That's radiation. That's energy. How many joules is red? Exactly. Because red is a color. Joules measure energy. Yeah, but your eyes are able to pick up certain frequencies. A frequency is basically something like this. Right? Now, when these things are closer to each other, we say that's a higher frequency. When these things are further away from each other. Because you see, think of this as a piece of information. Now this might sound like a physics lesson, a little bit. Think of this as pieces of information, right? A frequency is how often. That's what frequency means. How often? How frequently do they come and see you? How frequently do you see your parents? Means how often. Okay? So the frequency here means how often does one of these pieces of information come to you. Yeah, these two waves, they both travel at the same speed. That is the speed of light, which is referred to as by the letter C. It's a constant. These two waves, by waves, you know, frequencies are merely something like this, ladies and gentlemen. Now, can you not tell the frequency with which this oscillates? If I did this 10 times every minute, you'd say 10 times per minute. That's a frequency. If I did it 20 times, 20 times per minute. 200 times, 200 times per minute. That's what a frequency is. How often? Okay? Now, light or electromagnetic waves are the same. So there's an electrical wave that travels in this polarity. There's a magnetic wave that travels in the other. In other words, they're perpendicular to each other. So one goes like this. One goes like this and the other goes in this direction. It goes like this. So these two travel together. They propagate information. That's what they do. Information about the source. Information about where they're coming from. Because you can't do anything to them after they have left the source. I mean, you can using mirrors and things and so on. But the basic premise is that this is a way of communicating information. But not color. See, what color is being communicated here? This is merely a frequency. A frequency is simply, this is energy. Pulses of energy. That's why I said, you know, this is simply the frequency. The frequency with which a pulse of energy, meaning like a packet of energy, that's what scientists today call photons, a packet of energy, how often are you sending me a packet of energy? See, I'm trying to explain this concept to you so that you understand that color is not out there. It is not color that's out there. It's merely energy. What color is energy? What color is a banana? You'll say it's yellow. What color is the energy you get from eating a banana? There you go. It doesn't have a color. Now, have you not seen in a workshop when they, at an ironsmith, they heat metal? Okay? Why is it when you heat metal, it goes from whatever color, say it's black, then it goes red, then it goes orange, and sometimes it can go incandescent, meaning it can go white, right? White hot. So you have red hot, then it goes orange hot, right? Then it goes white hot. Sometimes you have blue first and then red, and then white at the end. What's going on are the atoms in the iron, in the object, are vibrating. They're oscillating. As they oscillate, it's the energy that has been provided by the heat, right? Because that's what you do. When you heat it up, you're giving energy. Yeah? You're giving energy. That energy is being absorbed by the object, which in turn starts vibrating. It starts vibrating. Once it starts vibrating, now it starts giving, it absorbs some of that energy and it starts giving out excess energy. That energy is released into the environment, which travels in the form of, you know, these are all packets of energy. So I'm trying to explain to you how it is that you see a red hot iron. If this is an iron, you hold it to the fire. After a while, it turns red. How does it turn red? How does a fire make it turn red? Is it the red in the fire that got to the iron? Yes, absolutely. Because the more energy that you supply, the frequency has to increase. Because it's the same speed, but more stuff. So if it's the same speed that these two will travel, but more stuff, then you have to have more of it going at the same time. Therefore, higher frequencies. So the higher the frequency, the higher the amount of energy that's being transferred. So that's why when you heat something up, more energy is given to the object and more energy is now being given off the object. And that energy travels through space and it comes into contact with your eye. Next day I'll show you a video of how it works. So it'll be easier to understand this. This is not meant to teach you physics. then we have a physics class. I'll bring a physicist and teach you that. We have plenty of the physicists in the room. They can do a better job than I can. The purpose of this is to help you figure that it is not color that's in the object. Because these are simply pulses of energy. And what color is energy? Energy does not have a color to be this color or that color. So then how come you see red? How do you see the colors of the rainbow then? See, when you heat something up, initially it goes red, and then orange. In fact, you can put down the colors of the rainbow. Yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. Now you see, on this side you have ultraviolet. On this side you have infrared. This is how the electromagnetic spectrum works. The higher the energy, the higher the frequency. Why the higher the frequency? Because in the same time, you have to give away, carry more energy. That's why. Another simple way to try and understand this, right? Let's say, every time I do this, I want you to read out a letter of the alphabet. Okay? Let's start from A. So I put my arm down. You have to give me the first letter of the alphabet. And the next time I do it, the next one, and the next one, and so on. Ready? Okay. So what happened? Frequency increased. As the frequency increased, more information came out, didn't it? What you had was data, information. So as the frequency increased, more came out in the same period of time. That's when we say something's traveling faster than something else. Same time, more stuff, faster. Yeah? So if now I can slow it down as well. Let's try that again. Get it? That is what frequency is. See, frequency is merely a measure of how often. When I did this fast, you were giving me letters of the alphabet faster than when I slowed down. That is a higher frequency. And when we slowed down, there was a slower frequency. Yeah? So now imagine if you had a lot to tell me. If you had lots to tell me and you had little time in which to do it, like the sermons that we do, right? Then what does Swaminathan tend to do? Speak faster and faster and faster until it comes to the point where it sounds gibberish to you. Makes no sense. But if I had a lot of time, but very little to tell you, like how pretty you all are, how beautiful you all are. I'm just jesting. You're all very pretty and very beautiful. Okay? Then I'd have little to say, but a lot of time in which to say it. Or if I had to say how wonderful the world is, not in the way that we spoke about in the morning, right? How pleasurable the world is, how wonderful, how many, you know, the greatest movies, then why we should go and see them. If you asked me to give a talk on that, what would I have to say? Nothing at all, really. So if you forced me to talk about it, then I'd have to take the whole 2 hours, right? And say very little, then I'd have to pace myself out and talk to you very slowly. But if I had a lot to say, Anichadukanatha, come on, ladies and gentlemen, let's do it quickly, as soon as we talk again, while the Buddha Sasana still lasts. Right? See, I have a lot to say before the Buddha Sasana comes to an end, I have to say this all to you. See, that is a lot of information, therefore higher frequency. Now, what color was that? So all there is out there is energy that can travel from one place to another at varying frequencies, not color. But then when you heat something up, right? In other words, you give more energy to an object. That's why when you take an iron and you heat it, right? It starts going red. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, it's like actually the iron is always vibrating. The atoms that make up an object are in constant vibration, but they're not vibrating enough so that this is your eye. There are cones and rods at the back of your eye. These cones and rods, they are sensitive to electromagnetic radiation, but they will only pick up certain frequencies, meaning they have to vibrate at a certain frequency. If they vibrate slower than that, they're not sensitive to that. You won't be able to see them. Not see, actually. These won't be stimulated. That's what. If you vibrate something faster than what they're capable of, again, you won't be able to perceive them because they won't be stimulated. It's like if I had an object to throw at you. Like, let's say I had some balls with me and I throw it at you. Your task is to take the ball, put it to a side. Take the next ball, put it to a side. Take the next one, put it to a side. Okay? Now, if I did it faster than you can catch them and put them to a side, then the balls will start falling beside you. If I did it very slow, you get bored and walk away. But if I give it to you at the right pace, at the pace at which you can pick it up, you can catch it and put it to a side, now that's the optimum. See, these are sensors. Like the sensors in the back of your camera, right? These sensors, they can only pick up certain vibrations. Remember, these are vibrations, not colors. And vibrations have a frequency. Every vibration has a frequency. That's why sometimes vibrations can shatter windows. That's called resonance. Because everything has a natural frequency. Natural frequency is the frequency at which its vibration is at its most, highest amplitude. See, these windows, they're stiff things, aren't they? They have a frame that goes around it. If you vibrate it too much, you know, these vibrations, if this is your window, looking at the window from the side, okay? This is from the side. This is a piece of glass. This glass, if you give it energy from one side, it's going to start vibrating. These vibrations are going to look like this. So this, it's going to take the same shape. So this glass is going to start doing that. That and this. So it's going to start doing this. What's going to start doing this? The glasses. But remember, there's a frame that's holding it from either side. So there comes a point where this bends far too much and the bonds between those atoms start to break. Therefore, the glass shatters. That's how a blast somewhere can shatter your windows. That's why in some places, if you have a jets flying at supersonic speeds, sometimes, it can cause damage to objects, especially glass at home. That's how sometimes, people, when they do opera, and there's a name for it which escapes me right now, you can sing at a very high pitch, right? You can actually do it. Take a very thin piece of glass, and if you can sing at a very high pitch, if you get to the natural frequency of this glass, it's going to shatter. So, once again, this is simply a physics lesson, but it's meant to give you the understanding that none of this is color. We haven't even entered the realm of color yet. We are all the time, did I ask you what color it was? Did we talk about reds, greens, blues, and so on? We are still talking about vibrations. Vibrations have frequencies. So, every object has a frequency. It's always vibrating. This, although you can't see it, is still vibrating. There are atoms that make this up. And these atoms are in vibration. Now, here's what happens when you take an iron rod and start heating it. As you start giving it energy, the molecules in this iron rod, they start taking in that energy and they start vibrating themselves. So when they start vibrating, they start giving off some of that energy. It absorbs some energy and it starts giving off some of that energy. So that energy is constantly being supplied by the fire, the source of energy. And as more energy is given to this, more energy is given out of this. So now what happens? It starts. These vibrations, let's say red is this kind of frequency. Okay, this frequency increases. Over here. So frequency increases. More energy. So as you heat things up, they start going from red to blue to white. White is when all these light rays are emitted at the same time. So when you see white, you're not only seeing, actually there is no such thing called white. What's really happening is all of this is coming at the same time. So what's black then? None of it is coming. That's what black is. So when these energy pulses, they come to the back of your eye, they are stimulated. What color? Exactly, there's no color. We can't talk about color, we are still talking about vibrations. Okay? So these vibrations, they stimulate these nerve endings, which then carry this signal to the brain, and now the brain has a job to do by interfacing with the mind, interpret these vibrations into something meaningful. But this meaning is only in the mind. So color is only something that the mind can see. There is no color out there. That's why I said, if these objects had color, you would not be seeing them today. Why do I say that? Because what do eyes pick up? Color or radiations? Radiations. They don't pick up color. Your eye is not sensitive to color. So therefore, if these objects had color, you wouldn't be seeing them. Last week we talked about taste, remember? If objects had taste, you wouldn't be able to taste them. If objects had smell, you wouldn't be able to smell them because you don't have smell receptors and taste receptors. What you have are shape receptors. In your nostrils and in your tongue, you have shape receptors. These are what those cells look like. They're not taste receptors. They're shape receptors, so you need a complementary shape to fit into that. So if you had a round hole, then you need a round peg. If you had a square hole, you need a square peg. When the two of them come into contact, now this is stimulated. It's a nerve cell that's stimulated, that's all. Now just imagine if there was actually taste in this world. Would you taste it? No. If there was smell in this world, would you be able to smell it? No, because you don't have smell receptors and taste receptors. That's why you wouldn't smell them. Imagine if there was sound in this world. Would you be able to hear it? This sounds really weird, doesn't it? If there was sound in this world, would you be able to hear it? Do you have a sound receptor? How do your eardrums work?
Vibrations.
So what are they then? Sound receptors or vibration receptors? They're vibration receptors. Just imagine if there was sound in the world out there. Would you hear it? No, the world would be silent. So isn't the word silent then? The world is silent. The world is colorless. It's tasteless. It's smellless. It's even touchless. So sights and sounds and smells and taste and touch, these things the world is void of. Does that make sense, ladies and gentlemen? Sights and sounds and smells and taste and touch, this world is void of that. It's devoid of all that. If the world had sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, you wouldn't be able to perceive them. So thankfully, they don't. Well, actually, we don't know if they have it. That is the truth. The answer to what color is this? In fact, does red live here? The answer to that would be, don't know. That's right. Why do you say don't know? Because if there was red here, how would we know? How would we know? You wouldn't be able to see it anyway, because your eye doesn't see red. Your eye only sees electromagnetic radiation. Pigments are simply molecules. What they do, like we have a natural pigment, we call it melanin. Right? That is our pigment. Human beings, we have it on our skin. So melanin simply takes in energy, absorbs some of it, and gives off some of it. So those who have less melanin in their skin, right, that energy falls on their skin and most of it is bounced back. That's how you look fair. You're not fair, really. You just have less of what I have. If you are fair, you have less of what I have. So if you're dark, you have more of it. What do those things do? Do they have color? No. So are the white white? Are the dark dark? Then what's this all fighting about, you know, we are dark and we are white and let's fight? Nonsense. There are no white people in this world and there are no dark people in this world. No fair people. There's no such thing. There are people on whose skin there is more melanin and less melanin. That's all. Absolutely, sir. Yeah. Like a dog, for example. A dog is sensitive to higher frequencies because their eardrums ours also vibrate. And there's a certain frequency after which they're destroyed. That's why they say don't stand near a bomb blast or something, right? If there's too high sounds, right, because in your ears there are little hairs. And these hairs have to vibrate. Next day I'll show you how the ear works. All of this is not to give you a biology lesson. It's simply to help you understand that what's out there is not what you perceive. Perception is purely a mental affair. So tell me then, do you live? No. So again. Do you think you live in the world that's out there? Or, do you understand what I'm trying to ask you? Yeah, that one. Yes, the world is only what you perceive. You create a world. This world that we believe that has sights and sounds, smells, taste, touch, it's not out there. This world is not so rich in color, you know, in sound. There's no such thing out there. All there are energies and they're vibrating. It's energy. That's what energy does. Energy is, it doesn't stay in one place. It's always traveling here or there. Because energy is always traveling, they have a frequency. That's what they do. Vibrations are always traveling. That's what they have a frequency. That's what they do. That is what energies do. They travel. They travel from one place to the other. But that is all that is there. Now, the problem is, if you like red, if you like the color red, and you think that redness is in this object, now you have an attachment to this object. You want to take this home. But the elephant that you imagined, that you didn't want to take home because you know that there is no object to which that image belongs. Because you know that you imagined that, right? Although you understand that you imagined, this one you think you didn't imagine, it's actually out here. Isn't it? Yes, it's the same as the elephant. Because just as much as the elephant is a mental creation, which we call a perception, which we can say is an imagination, this redness is also a mental creation, a perception, an imagination. It is an imagination. This redness does not exist out here. All there are pigments, and all of that is made of the four basic elements. So could someone attach themselves to the four basic elements? What do you think? Why not? Exactly. You can't see them, you can't smell them, you can't taste them, you can't sense, you can't taste them, you can't touch them. How many things that you can't see, smell, taste or touch are you attached to? You can't see, you can't hear, you can't smell, you can't taste, you can't touch. How many of such things are you attached to today? None. Why not? Duh. If you don't know of their existence, how can you be attached to them, right? That is why you can't be attached to the four basic elements. So then, don't you understand that you cannot be attached to what's out in the world if you really understand what's out there? Once you understand that all there is out there are the four basic elements which you have never seen, you've never heard, you've never smelled, you've never tasted, and you never sensed. So you don't even know that it's there. Thankfully, the Buddha, in his wisdom, He has all, and the wisdom to reveal all. So he doesn't have to be able to see it physically. That is what his wisdom does for him. Right? Four incalculable eons of practice and paramita fine-tunes his mind such that it becomes sensitive to what's out there really. That only comes with paramita. So unless the Buddha reveals to us that the four basic elements are out there, there's no other way that anyone could come to understand that, because well, we don't perceive it. What we don't perceive, we don't know exists. So do aliens exist? You can't answer that question because we still haven't perceived the existence of aliens. So they may not. And so just because you can't hear doesn't mean such vibrations don't exist. That's why, as the good gentleman said earlier, dogs, you know, there are animals who are sensitive to more frequencies. Now, so then do ghosts and spirits, do they exist? Do devas exist? The safest answer today is yes or no. We don't know. We don't know. If you ask me, I have an answer. Not that I don't know. I know they exist. But I have never perceived them. But through cause and effect, I can understand of their existence. Because if what you give is what you get, right? If one has practiced the characteristics of giving charity, then that is what deva is. So if deva is to give, then one who has given plentiful in abundance must be a deva. What you do, what you give is what you get back. That's how it works. Through that I understand that. And if someone has, all they've been doing in their lives is creating misery and agony for others and creating life, making life a hell for others, then, you know, you need not ask the question, is there a hell? Because if someone has lived their life making life hell for others, then it is only right that they get what they deserve. Not what they desire. Because nobody desires to go to hell. But if that is what they deserve, that's what they get. That's all it is. So, that's a side point. But coming back to what we're talking about, we are attached to a world that we create in our own minds. So this sight that you're attached to, now when you look at a pretty girl, right? Ladies in the house, you can think of it the other way. But if you're attached to a pretty girl, the sight of a pretty girl, you feel like the sight belongs to the girl. That's what I'm saying. You think she's fair. If you like a girl, if you like a fair girl, right? Then you think the fairness is hers. Right? It belongs to her. So now you want to take her home because you think she's fair. If you like a dark girl, you think darkness is hers. It is because she's dark you want to take her home. That makes no sense because she's neither fair nor dark. Right? Then you'll say, no, it's not just her looks, Swaminathan. I like the sound of her voice. What sound is her voice? She sounds very sweet when she sings. You know, this, you're giving her undue credit. For your own doing, you're crediting someone else. Where's the sound appearing? In your own mind, you're perceiving sound, but you're giving credit to the girl. That doesn't make sense. And then you say, she smells nice, though, Swamina. She smells nice. Really? Where's that smell? It's a creation of the mind. She doesn't have smell, she has shapes. Those shapes come and fit into your shape receptors. Then that triggers a stimulus. That triggers an impulse. That impulse is perceived by the mind interfacing with the brain as a smell. Is that her smell? Does she have a smell? No. Dare I say, you'll say, she tastes nice. What does that mean? She feels nice. What does that mean? Her hair is silky. What does that mean? Her skin is so smooth. Very supple. What does that mean? No such thing exists in the body outside. Out there is merely the four basic elements. They don't have a touch. They don't have a smell. They don't have a taste. They don't have a sight. They don't have a sound. It's a senseless world. That's why people do senseless things, right? So you create that world in your mind, and then you think, you give credit to the outside world. You think these are from the outside. That's what, remember, that's what I said the five senses do. As you open your eyes, you project the sight that's in your mind, that image that you create in your mind, into the outside world. So when I see this gentleman here, what my eyes help me do is project that image onto the four basic elements that's over there, and then I think what I'm seeing is a gentleman. I see the image of the gentleman. I feel that the image belongs to the gentleman. So if the image belongs to the gentleman and I like what I see, now I've got to take him home. You want to stay home? You should. That's the thing. Now, you know, once you understand this, how can you attach yourself to the physical world out there? Did you actually let go of anything as you were listening to me? Or did you just understand that there was nothing to let go of? All I'm helping you understand is that the things that you think are out there are not actually out there. Now, what do you have to let go? There you go. That's why right from the beginning I've been saying, Buddhism is not about letting go. Buddhism is about realizing. That's why Nibbana is a realization. Realize. Realize. Realize the truth. We realize the truth. That's all you have to do. Just realize what's actually there and you're no longer attached to it. Attachment can only come out of ignorance. You see? Now do you see the connection between attachment and ignorance? If you believe that sight is in the object, that is ignorance. Is there wisdom or ignorance? That's ignorance. Now if you think that the sight is in the object, now of course you attach yourself to the object. No wonder. But once you realize that the sight that I'm attached to is not in the object, let that be. I no longer have anything to do with the object. Yes, your attachment to the sight might still be there. What you saw, the image might still be there. But for that, we've already discussed from, you know, dog knows when, how long, we've been discussing about how attachment to objects are simply caused by ignorance and vexation, right? And pleasure don't come from the sights. Yeah, we talked about the second part of this at the beginning, long time ago. The reason that you like a particular taste is because you think it's pleasurable. Right? But did we not already answer that question? You think taste is pleasurable, that is delicious, but that's merely relief from vexation. So once you put those two things together, the understanding of pleasure and vexation, and that pleasure does not come from sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, which we've been talking about for donkey's years. And then today you understand that these sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, they're not in the objects. Put the two of them together. Bring those two understandings together and what do you have? Nibbana. Full realization. See, a sight is not in the object. Let go of the object, but you still want the sight. Why do you want the sight? Because it's pleasurable. Is pleasure in the sight? No, it's merely relief from vexation. Once you understand that, do you want any longer need the sight? No. So initially you let go of the object. Second, you let go of the sight. Now what are you attached to? Nothing. First you let go of vastu karma, then you let go of klesha karma. This is all karma, sensuality. Initially you let go of the object. Second, you let go of sensuality. Sensuality is the expectation of pleasure from sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. The attachment to objects is a misunderstanding, is caused by the misunderstanding that those sights, sounds, smells, taste, and touch are in the objects. That's why you want the objects. You eat food because you think nourishment comes from the food. Right? But once you understand that, if you thought that nourishment didn't come from the food, you wouldn't eat it. That's why this you don't eat. You can't get whatever you want from this for your body sustenance. So you're attached to objects is because you're first attached to sights. Yeah? You think sights are pleasurable. Now where is the sight? in the object. Therefore, you need the object. But if you understand now that the sight is not in the object, you still want the sight, but not the object. Make sense? As you continue your practice, you realize that sight is also not pleasurable, because pleasure does not come from the object. It is merely experience of relief from vexation. Now you no longer want the sight either. So for first you let go of the object, second you let go of sight. Now what are you attached to? Nothing. Long live the Sambuddha Sasana. Doesn't freedom taste good? Doesn't this understanding taste good? Does it not feel good? Just, you know, just merely opening your eyes, you know, for the first time, really, my goodness. The lunacy that we've been living in. This make-believe world that we've been living in. This creation, this wizardry that we've been living in. It's like we've been living in a bubble. This is fool's paradise. But now you understand that none of these things are actually out in the world out there. These are all creations of the mind. This is all done out of Abhisankara and Sankara working together. Right? And then once that ceases, now Sabba Sankara Samato. And once Sabba Sankara Samato, Sabbupati Pari Nissaggo, Tanhakyo, Virago, Nirodo, Nibbananti. That's Nibbana. So I wish and pray that all of you understand this Dhamma as soon as you can, as soon as your merits let you do that. It is merits after all. Remember, this understanding is also driven by cause and effect. You can't understand something just because you want to. You can't understand something just because you want to.
We want to try to memorize as much as we can.
Not going to work. Yeah, it's no guarantee. But once you put the work into it, then you become deserving of it, isn't it? Yeah, if you don't speak a language, you don't understand what is said in the language. Right? But you start putting the work into it. And then over time, you become deserving of it because you put in the work. Then you become, once you become deserving of it, now things start coming to you. So, therefore, to whatever extent you have understood what we have talked about today, it is not my doing. It is your doing. Your merits have paved the path for you to understand this. There are two things coming together here. Causes and conditions. Causes are with you. I'm only creating the conditions. Right? When causes and conditions come together, you have an effect. The conditions are here. That is the pratya. The causes you have, that is the hetu. Hetu and pratya together, they create an effect. That is your understanding. I can only give you pratya. That's why even when you do a merit transfer, what is the proper term for a merit transfer? Pratya anumodana. But you have to have the causes. Causes of being devoted towards the sasana. Right? Understanding what the sasana is about. Having respect towards the sasana. Having devotion towards the sasana. Having obeisance towards the sasana. Hold the sasana in high regard. That's when, if someone comes up to you and says, today we offered alms to 100 monks. In your mind, if you understand what the monks stand for, what the community of the Mahasangha represent, then you go sadhu sadhu. Where was the hetu? That was with you. What the person came up to you and did was give you the pratyaya, which is the conditions, that's all. So without the conditions, there's no point in simply having the causes. But there's no point in having the causes without the conditions. The two of them have to come together. That's why noble association is so important, because noble association can only give you the conditions. You need merits because those are the causes. Your merits and noble association together, That creates the effect. That is your realization of Dhamma. Do you see how it works now? Simples. Time's up. Let's take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, listening to the Dhamma, inviting the Swaminathans to deliver the sermon, and as well as creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the teaching and attain to their salvation. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhunis and bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, let us transfer these merits to them, for it is they who have shed blood, sweat and tears to protect and preserve the Dhamma and pass it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to all the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swaminathanse, as well as all the monks resident in the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by translating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits help and continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employees and our employers, our teachers, those who have gone the extra mile on our behalf and have left no stone unturned to make our lives comfortable and easy to live. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they also be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to protecting and preserving the Sambuddha Sasana. May they all rejoice in these merits, and let us also transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives, our forefathers, our ancestors, those who lost their lives, members of our families and friends, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us be grateful for all that they have done for us. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. Let us also transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe, as well as those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, as well as the pandemics. Reminding ourselves that in this infinite long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us. They'll have gone the extra mile on our behalf. They'll have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. And therefore, with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness towards all of them, let us transfer all the merits we have acquired to all of them. If any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may they rejoice in these merits and be freed from those woeful plains. May they be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of Arahants on this blessed land, And when you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Theranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midatnva Dvesha ginnen midatnva Moha ginnen midatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivansapa labeva Nivansapa labeva Nivansapa labeva
Tunruvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen Sīlu loka sīlu sattvayoma Nibbāna parama sukhen sukhita taravetvā Sādhu, sādhu, sādhu.